difficult to say exactly when the study of religions as opposed to theology began in the English-speaking world. The first academic appointment in the field in America, I think, was that of William Fairfield, to be the professor of comparative theology at Harvard in 1873. By the late 19th century, there were posts in comparative theology at Princeton, Theological Seminary, Cornell, Harvard, Chicago, and Brown universities. These were all designated as theological posts, and they were naturally held by Christian theologians. In Britain, one of the first scholars to study world religions was Friedrich Max Müller, here, who edited the 50-volume series Sacred Books of the East, and who in 1873 wrote An Introduction to the Science of Religion, which Eric Sharp has described as the foundation document of comparative religion. But though Müller was a vitally important figure in the compilation and translation of Sanskrit texts, his post at Oxford was actually in modern languages. The first post in comparative religion in Britain was that of Joseph Carpenter at Manchester College, then a Unitarian college in London in 1876. It's now, of course, in Oxford. One of the founding members of the British Academy, A.M. Fairbairn, took a similar post at Mansfield College, Oxford, in 1886, so that's roughly the time period. It wasn't really until 1967 in Britain that the first department of religious studies was founded at Lancaster and developed under the leadership of Minion Smart. Now, most universities in Britain have some course in which theology and religious studies are very often run either in parallel or in overlap or together. The first British university post in the study of religion as a non-theological, non-Christian discipline was that of E.B. Tyler to the readership in anthropology here at Oxford in 1884. Tyler aimed to produce in his now almost entirely unread book, Primitive Culture, a naturalistic explanation of religion which would make no appeal to the supernatural or to revelation. And he suggested a minimal definition of religion as belief in spiritual beings. All sorts of difficulties with that definition, partly on the ground that perhaps it's too intellectual, that religion isn't just a matter of belief, partly on the ground that spiritual beings are perhaps a little bit too narrow to describe the objects of religious belief. Nevertheless, it's not too far from the mark, I think. If one's going to have a general definition of religion which covers a reasonably broad range of human practices and beliefs, which might hopefully be grouped together, then that definition will necessarily be rather vague and will invite those who like defining things to invent many further sub-definitions. And proposed definitions, as you know, range from that of the sociologist Spiro, a culturally patterned interaction with culturally postulated superhuman beings, to that of Max, it sounds like a film, doesn't it, Superman 3, to that of Max Müller, perception of the infinite insofar as it's able to influence the moral character of man. At one end of the spectrum, to speak of the postulation of superhuman beings seems to imply a rather negative view of religions as inventing anthropomorphic superhuman heroes, perhaps to explain why the sun rises or the rain falls. At the other end, religion seems to disappear into the miasma of the infinite, wherein all distinctions are merged into one all-enveloping romantic fog. Specific definitions of religion do express the inclinations of their propagators. Nevertheless, I would think that both superhuman beings and the infinite refer to supernatural reality, that is, a reality which is other and, in some sense to be further defined, greater than publicly observable material objects, and which exists objectively, that is, independently of human beings. So I pick out three qualities, really, of the supernatural. It's other than human, it's objective, and it is greater, in some sense, than things which exist in physical material reality. In many indigenous religions, a host of good and bad spirits is said to exist, causing fertility, victory, war, plagues, earthquakes, and death. Holy men, sometimes women, are thought to be able to communicate with these spirits and to influence them to help to produce human good or avoid human harm. In the earliest city-states of which we possess records, like Sumer, pantheons of gods and goddesses who are often said to have descended from more ultimate primal powers of being, see chaos, represent various aspects of human activity, from war to music, or become patrons of particular rulers and cities, or symbolize the powers which are expressed in natural forces like the sun and the stars, which have their own reality. After the 8th to the 6th centuries BCE, at the beginning of what Karl Jaspers called the Axial Age, which is from 800 to 200 BCE, he said, a number of religious teachers whose names have been recorded and remembered founded some of the great religious traditions which still exist in the world. So, the major prophets of Israel and Judah founded a great tradition of the worship of one God of justice and mercy, which was, in time, to give rise to the Semitic faiths of Judaism, Christianity and Islam. Mahavira and Gautama, in the same period, founded the Indian traditions of renunciation and the pursuit of a liberated state of wisdom, compassion and bliss. The many Indian traditions which now comprise Hinduism reconfigured their own diverse teachings around these central themes of renunciation and liberation, and interpreted the gods as personalizations of the one ultimate reality of which all things are parts. Confucius and Lao Tzu founded the East Asian traditions which are concerned with the harmony of nature and the discernment of the way of heaven in social and political life. And then in the 4th century BCE, Plato and Aristotle devised philosophical systems which, while not themselves religions, were to shape the character of the Semitic traditions, at least in fundamental ways. So these four streams of thought have developed, divided, and interacted ever since, and they could be said to express an almost universal human concern with a supernatural reality, conceived either as a personal god to whom humans can relate in worship, as a liberated state to which humans have access, as an immanent moral order which underlies the observable cosmos, or as the supreme good which draws all things to itself by desire, the four great models I've mentioned. So it looks as though there's something called religion, but it might be helpful to call religion, concerned with a supernatural reality, and these four major different models for conceiving it developed in the 8th to the 4th centuries BCE. But in recent years, many scholars, both in anthropology and in cultural studies, have questioned whether religion is an appropriate or even an identifiable subject of study. Wilfred Cantwell Smith, probably the best known, in The Meaning and End of Religion, argued that the concept of religion is a recent, Western, and unstable concept, and the term should be dropped. Trying to turn religion into an object of study, he says, turns a matter of living faith into a set of abstract, frozen doctrines, as though there were a number of religions, each with a fixed essence. He recommends that we should separate the many cumulative traditions, which are always in flux, always changing, from the lived experience of faith, of personal relation to the transcendent, I'm using his terms. Others argue that it's artificial to separate religion from the general cultural life of a society. Wendy James, professor of anthropology here, has said that, although he's written a very good book about the religion of one particular African tribe. We may speak of the beliefs and practices of various cultures and the way they change in response to new environmental and economic pressures and opportunities. So religion might be subsumed under cultural studies, which wouldn't give comparative theology much of a look in, I'm not saying. Since it would falsify the situation entirely to see it as a matter of static sets of doctrines set down in written texts by a small scholarly elite. Well, my response to these quite widespread moves is that it can indeed be misleading to see religions as separate and distinct entities which are defined by lists of doctrines. Even to see Christianity, which I think is particularly creed-based like this, is misleading if it leads one to neglect its very diverse social embodiments and its historically changing forms. Yet Cantwell Smith himself states that the cumulative traditions are the ground for individual faith in transcendence, for which he uses a capitalized T. In using the concept of transcendence, he is focusing attention on a supernatural reality and on the possibility of personal experience of it. For the transcendent is precisely that which is beyond and greater than the immanent, in the sense of the everyday. And thereby he's in fact picking out precisely what is central to religion, as distinct from music, morality, or social custom. So I think there are practices intended to relate humans appropriately to such a transcendent or supernatural reality, or realities, plural. And presumably there are some alleged apprehensions of it or them by at least some human beings. If so, it's possible to speak of a distinctive area of human belief, practice, and experience in which humans seek to relate to a supernatural order of being in ways intended to attain human goods or avoid human harms. One can call such beliefs, practices, and experiences religious, and they can become the objects of reflective and analytical study. The study of religions may no doubt be part of cultural studies, though it'll also be concerned with questions of rationality and truth that cultural studies often sets aside. But it's primarily a study of those beliefs, practices, and experiences in which humans consider themselves to have a potentially fulfilling relation to an objective, transcendent reality. This is getting towards what I mean by comparative theology. There doesn't seem to be anything particularly Western, elitist, or essentialist about such a study, nor does the study of religion require or commit the scholar to any presuppositions about what he or she should believe or practice. Tyler's own studies certainly fall under this general description of the study of religions, though he himself, like most early anthropologists, was not interested in questions of the truth of religious beliefs, because he assumed that they were all false. His minimal definition in terms of spiritual beings also falls under this general description that I've given, even though it may seem a little odd to speak of the infinite, of nirvana, of the way of heaven, or of the good as spiritual beings. In the broad sense, they nevertheless are. Those who speak of perceptions of the infinite are speaking of the apprehension of a supreme spiritual being. Those who are indifferent to anthropomorphic gods and who aim at liberation from suffering through meditation believe in spiritual beings, who could be the enlightened ones of Buddhism or the Tirthankaras of Jainism. But in both cases, they're beings who've attained spiritual states which are other and greater than the mundane states of ordinary sense awareness. Those who follow the way of heaven are seeking to follow a moral order which is built into the universe as its transcendent dimension. To check this, Dr. Young, one might prefer to speak of a spiritual dimension to reality rather than a spiritual being. Yet, insofar as these views are religious, they do affirm an objective spiritual aspect of being. And then those who seek awareness of an objective good regard it as a spiritual existence, even when they are apt to say, as Plato did, that it is beyond being itself. So the study of religions, I think, has an object, and that object is global. And you can trace its history in broad outlines and say there are many streams of human thought aiming at relationship which is fulfilling and good to a transcendent reality. There are many ways, of course, of studying religions. I won't talk about the anthropological or the psychological, but I will say a word about the phenomenology of religions, a term often used in many different ways, however. The term phenomenology is influenced by the work of the philosopher Edmund Husserl. It carries with it a great deal of theoretical freight, and it's been used, as far as I can find it, in at least three quite different senses in the literature. In one sense, which I think is typified by Ninian Smart, it asks only for an accurate, value-neutral description of observable religious phenomena, so phenomenology. An account of religious beliefs and practices which sets aside, or brackets, questions of truth and falsity, and works to no theological or ideological agenda. It's an attempt to describe phenomena as they appear, without any presuppositions, and without any framework of already existing theoretical beliefs. That's one sense in which phenomenology is used. In a second sense, which is nearer to the philosophy of Husserl himself, phenomenology is an attempt to arrive at an understanding of the essence of the phenomena being described, the essence of religion. Schleiermacher's question. by what Husserl called eidetic intuition, one might discern the essential and universal forms which underlie all the contingencies of historical phenomena. One classifies and relates phenomena in ideal types, recording the essence of appearances, though without making any judgment as to their ultimate truth or falsity. Gerardus van der Leeuw introduced this approach in his Phenomenology of Religion, which is in English as Religion in Essence and Manifestation. There's just one copy in Oxford, which is in Regent's Park. And van der Leeuw held that the... You've got a wolf. Oh. It's only one on OList anyway. only one recorded on the computer. Van der Leeuw held that the key phenomenological ideas around which religions are based are the ideas of power, will, and form, which define the object of religious faith. The basic religious experience for him is that of a strange, wholly other power, which obtrudes into life and is met with astonishment and awe. You see the link with Rudolf Otto. That's the second sense of phenomenology. A third, related but different sense, stresses the element of empathy, Einfühlen, self-surrendering love, even, that is needed to attend to the religious experiences of others as they appear to them. One seeks to enter into the experiences of others and live them from the inside, as it were. This requires an appreciation for religious feeling and a participative understanding of the lives of others, and results in an engaged, particularized relation to other cultures and persons, which is far removed from any neutral or value-free inquiry. So you see the big difference between these three uses of the word. Nevertheless, these three senses overlap and are often confused, so that it can be unclear whether a researcher is attending only to appearances, what religion looks like when described reasonably objectively, or searching for essences, what's really the essence of religion, or seeking to have deeply empathetic experiences, what it's like to be a member of a religious group. The only thing that is clear is that the approach of the phenomenologist is different from that of most anthropologists, whose concern has been with explaining social behaviour. Though even here, if an anthropologist stresses the need for participant observation, it may be that such participation will lead to a phenomenological interest, though anthropologists disagree quite a lot among themselves about whether that is true or not. Should you, if you're a participant observer, try to share the experiences of the group, or is that prohibited? Is it professionally not allowed? Quite difficult. But coming nearer to a theological view, I think it's a third sense of phenomenology which would be most relevant, because this involves the capacity to have experiences which may be an important part of learning to appreciate and to have participant knowledge of religious beliefs and practices. Whereas a naturalistic study of religion requires a certain distancing from religious belief, a more empathetic study might presuppose the ability to know what it feels like to have such a belief. And that might require that you're actually a participant in one such belief yourself. Otherwise, how would you know what it felt like? Participation in rituals and engagement in the creative interpretation of beliefs, at least in an imaginative sense, may be a condition for understanding religion. And one would expect this to be true if religion indeed claims to mediate relationship with supernatural reality. Just as it would be absurd to study music without some attempt to increase appreciation of music and to develop the skills of musicianship, so it might be absurd to study religion without some attempt to increase appreciation of prayer, meditation, and worship, and to develop the skills needed to interpret religious texts and to understand one's life from a religious viewpoint. You can see this is getting very near to theology. That's on the borderline between study of religion and theology. There is another area with which theology deals, however, which phenomenology has traditionally disclaimed any interest in, and that is truth and rationality. The bracketing of truth is quite important to a phenomenologist. And yet I think to a theologian, questions of truth and rationality are quite important. This is the area which is an overlap between philosophy and theology. Philosophy, I think, attempts to investigate religious claims, if it does, as fully and yet as critically as possible, raising all possible objections, assessing various arguments as dispassionately as possible, perhaps proposing a best theory in awareness that it won't be universally agreed. Philosophy will not, as a discipline, be committed to any position in advance, even though individual philosophers will inevitably begin with a set of beliefs which may or may not change as they pursue their studies. Philosophy typically does not accept a set of revealed truths as given, and so considers itself free to consider many claims to revelation among its other objects of study. How far is theology like that? Genuine question, but I'm going to give an answer. Theology has often been construed as a confessional discipline which is committed to one religious position, and there are, of course, quite properly, confessional theologies. But it is, I think, possible to have a comparative theology, and remember that's where the study of religions began in the English-speaking world, which takes as its data, as far as is possible, the whole religious history of humanity, which I've sketched in such a short way. Already we have something you could call ecumenical Christian theology, which supports the exploration of Christian faith from many perspectives. In fact, that's what we have in practice in Oxford, because the teachers of theology in our faculty are not belonging to any one variety of Christian belief: Catholic, Protestant, Plymouth Brethren, Anglican, all sorts of peculiar things like that. Why then should a fully ecumenical global theology not exist, which supports the exploration of faith from the whole range of human religious perspectives? I do think that a fully ecumenical theology would be wider than Christian. Ecumene means the whole world. Admittedly, there are some religious traditions, and this is a trouble, like Buddhism or Jainism, which do not have theologies, since they don't have a great interest in God. That complicates the situation verbally. However, the response to this, which I'm glad to receive from my classicist colleagues, is that the word theos in Greek does not mean God, but refers more widely to the element of the sacred or the divine. If we can return to a broad sense of theos as the sacrality or the impact of a supernatural being or state on human experience, then Buddhists and Jains would be able to be embraced within that very wide view of theology. I wouldn't insist on that, but it is etymologically possible. Now, the distinction, I think, between comparative philosophy of religion and comparative theology or religion is vanishingly small. That's because I'm a philosopher, but I do think it is. And it may consist largely in the fact that theology is more concerned with history, with religious organization and ritual, and with religious practice than philosophy tends to be. In fact, if you look at what we do in theology, there's more of that than you get in the philosophy faculty. In addition, comparative theology may suggest a sympathy with and an appreciation for the religious aspirations and experiences of humanity. The study of religions doesn't have to be comparative. But where it is, there's a tendency to speak of traditions not as just embodying true or false claims, but as systems of symbols for a rather generally conceived idea of the transcendent, which is the final section of what I have to say. This is because, why should we talk in general about the transcendent, the supernatural? I mean, what I'm getting at here is that a truly comparative theology wouldn't be talking about God, really. It'd be talking about the supernatural, the transcendent, which is a very vague term, but why use that? I think because one might not wish to regard all religious experience as illusory, which would imply that a great number of the most devout, morally committed and reflective humans, as well as many charlatans, of course, were grossly deluded. Nevertheless, the incompatibilities between their particular accounts of the object or objects they experience are so great that they cannot all be literally true. if one doesn't make a special exception of one tradition, the most obvious hypothesis is that their specific accounts are imaginative symbols which take their form from local cultures, although there is some underlying reality to which they point, which is a genuine objective reality. It's at this stage that some doubt whether one can find any such underlying reality at all. I often have it said by my own colleagues in theology, if you don't have God, even the Christian God, you don't have anything. You either have that or you've got nothing. So some people would doubt there is anything that you're talking about if you move to the transcendent. John Hick is perhaps the best known figure who holds that there is such an underlying reality, which he calls the real, of which, unfortunately, he says, we know nothing at all, which is a bit disappointing. But any attempt to be less vague than that seems to leave one with something that not all religious believers would agree about. Suppose, for example, that one talks of one supremely valuable absolute reality, which I'm tempted to do. Well, that would be widely agreed, but many Buddhists, and Paul Williams from Bristol in particular, might protest, well, he's not a Buddhist, but he used to be, might protest that this is exactly such a thing that they're wanting to reject when they say that all things are empty of inherent existence, that there is not one supremely valuable absolute reality. But even they, even Paul Williams, when pressed, does agree to speak of one supremely valuable state of consciousness, which it is the object of meditation to attain. It's not a cause, it's not a substantial being, like a personal God. One could say that they really are in contact with an absolute reality, though they don't recognize it as such, but then you're taking a particular position about how to describe it correctly, and you're saying that they're mistaken in their description of the object of their belief. My point here is that it's coherent to say that they do in fact point to the reality of the absolute, even if they do not mean to do so, or say that they're not doing it. But you have to accept that if you say something like that, you're privileging one account of the religious object, saying that some tradition or traditions has a more correct account than the others. It looks as if the most one can say is that religious narratives are concerned with superhuman, more valuable or powerful than human, beings or states, but they really do have differing ideas of such states or beings. They cannot all be correct. They cannot even all be more or less equally roughly correct. Some must be wrong, even if none are absolutely right. As a matter of fact, it might be more accurate to say that religious positions spread out to fill every possible space in the array of modes of relationship between the transcendent and the physical cosmos than that they all agree. So religions give you virtually every possibility of relationship to a transcendent and how to conceive it. Nevertheless, I would hold that there is a general descriptive core which fits many ideas of the transcendent. In many traditions, there is said to be a supreme reality which embodies perfection, and that perfection includes such characteristics as wisdom, freedom, compassion, and bliss. Virtually all theistic faiths and the renouncing traditions of Buddhism and Jainism would affirm that there is such a reality, whether it is God or the state of finally liberated souls. The goal of the religious life is accessing that reality, and in general, the goal is to be achieved by overcoming egoism, hatred, greed, and ignorance. That's my descriptive core. You don't have to go as far as John Hick in denying all knowledge of the real in itself, but I do think it is reasonable to accept his pluralistic hypothesis, stated in his words as that the great post-axial faiths constitute different ways of experiencing, conceiving, and living in relation to an ultimate divine reality which transcends all our varied visions of it. This doesn't commit you to saying that all these ways are of equal truth or efficacy. It doesn't commit you to saying that just one of them has all important truths adequately formulated. It's quite possible to say that in many religious ways people are justified in believing what they do on the basis of their experience and of the plausibility of the tradition as they see it. Presumably, some set of propositions expressing religious truths is the most adequate in fact. But we may not know what it is, and we may not even have formulated it yet. Since religious traditions live mainly by images and metaphors, which spring from the originative experiences and teachings of major religious figures, the question of theoretical truth may indeed be less important in practice than the personal efficacy of the images, and leading one from egoism towards union with the reality of compassion and bliss. So one may consistently be committed to one tradition of images as efficacious and illuminating, while allowing that other traditions may be so for other people, and that it's not known for certain which set of truths, if any of those known to us, is most adequate. So, one way in which comparative theology can proceed is to be committed to one religious tradition, thereby showing one's commitment to understanding religious practice and experience, in fact, and to seek to deepen and extend the religious imagination by practical encounters with a range of religious traditions, their devotional practices and ways of seeing the world. I would call this participative understanding, which requires a much more personal involvement than the participant observation recommended now by most anthropologists, for it requires an initial sympathy for religion, a capacity for religious feeling, and a determination to extend one's experience beyond the boundaries of one's own tradition. Comparative theology may seem dangerous, but it might also be liberating.
Take questions first, or should I respond first?
I don't mind. I'm sorry if it was too much black electric. Another apology. I apologize for being.
Maybe, I mean, I do have a few comments to get us started discussion, but maybe if there are questions for clarification first, smaller questions. Okay, well, let me just throw out a few comments, which I'll do fairly briefly because I think a lot of it reflects what you heard 3 weeks ago from me. Good. And I think I've in reading your books and in hearing you speak them, I think it's extremely illuminating your approach, and I appreciate very much hearing what you say. And I'd be curious whether you think we all will agree or not, because I think for the most part we do. I mean, I think a number of things are fairly obvious, and just hearing you reflecting on the history of the development of religious studies is, first of all, that theology disconnected from religion, I don't think makes very much sense. And sometimes people will throw up against theologians, well, what about living religious practices or living religious communities? And certainly, I think it's a fairly well-recognized point in Catholic theological circles today that theologians have to be connected to the life of the church, and there has to be a sense of worship, and there has to be a sense of social context. So I think, in general, I would say, and I think it would fit with what you're saying, that a theology that somehow functions as if religion doesn't exist is bad theology. And that seems to me at least I'd be willing to argue for that. I also think that theology that functions as if religious studies or the study of religion doesn't exist is probably bad theology. Partially because the terms aren't owned by theologians. And theologians can't say, you know, I will stipulate what religion means, or I will stipulate what the transcendent means. But in fact, our environment is very much affected by cultural differences, but also by the whole academic world in which most theologians function. And that for a theologian to say, well, I will now ignore everything that people, scholars of religion, talk about, seems to make no sense. I also personally feel that And I'd say this to myself, but also to my colleagues in Boston, it's very easy if you're a theologian to become kind of chauvinistically turned in, as if we, who are increasingly a smaller and smaller group, know what we're talking about. And one of the values of scholars of religion in places like the American Academy of Religion and so on is to keep opening it up again and say, well, you don't own the topic you're talking about, and you can't define your terms by yourself, and you need somebody to ask the questions you're not asking. And so many times in contexts like these seminars we've been having on Tuesdays in the study of religion, well, what are you even talking about when you use the word religion? Is something theologians often just skip over and keep moving, and I think that connection is important. The issue you raise about doctrines and how kind of religious communities that are theologically self-conscious can be defined by their doctrines is certainly an issue that's not going to go away, I think, because I don't think communities don't simply invent doctrines to build borders around themselves. But I think, you know, different religious traditions in different parts of the world in some way do articulate doctrines. Now, it's very much more advanced in some than in others. I say that neutrally, not as a sense of progress. But it seems hard for a community to talk as if there were no kind of increasing claims about the nature of the world and the nature of truth and so on. And I don't see any reason to leave that out of theology or considering religion, that one of the things religious people do is form teachings and explain themselves and make claims about what's wrong with other people's beliefs. And that seems to me to be worthy of religious study, just as ritual performances or pilgrimages or dream analysis or something. I mean, why not take doctrine seriously? And I also think, related to that, it's also easy for theologians to stereotypically discount what scholars of religion do, as if to say, well, we take truth seriously and they don't, or we believe in God and they don't. And the stereotypes can go in both ways, and I think what you're doing in part by connecting these histories is extremely valuable and important. One of the ways I see, just to add to that, if we can sort of agree that theology and religious studies need to be interconnected, and theology and religion are categories, both theoretically and practically, that need to be interconnected, theology and religion, and you've said this already, are interconnected, but if theology and religions are connected, then theology and theologies are interconnected. And that's again where I agree with you in talking about if we can have Anglicans and Catholics and Orthodox and others at a place like Oxford, it's not as if theologizing is an invention of the Christian tradition or only Christians do this. And it doesn't make sense, at least with the study of Hinduism, and I think Islam and other traditions, particularly if we use your sentence theos and expand it, that people are critically, articulately thinking about their faith, and they know the difference between the thinking about their faith and the practices of their faith, and to somehow engage in an interreligious communication in which that kind of theological self-consciousness and self-articulation is left out wouldn't make any sense. And to be a good theologian or a good scholar of religion seems to need to take that kind of second level theorizing into account, how traditions do that, and I think that matters. The whole issue of whether one can pin down what's true or not, or what really matters or not, and I think on one level we have to be open as human beings and as scholars, both, to the fact that other people do perceive the world differently, and that I may have a very intense sense of what is true and how salvation happens, or what happens after death, or whether there's a God or not. And I have on one level to be very open to the fact that other people, in fact, who care deeply about what they believe, see it otherwise and practice it otherwise. But I find it more interesting, and probably we agree on this too, is to talk to other people who care deeply about these things is more interesting than to talk to people who don't care deeply about these things. And I'd rather talk to somebody who is deeply committed and deeply involved in their religious tradition and in religious practice, even if they seem to be kind of diametrically opposite to mine, than to somebody who says, well, what you believe is nice and what somebody else believes is nice, but I don't particularly have any strong opinion about any of them. I find it easier to talk to the believer in the other tradition who cares much more deeply, even if their belief seems to collide with mine. And I think for a lot of theologians, that's my perception is, and again, this, a lot of this is based more on Boston, obviously, than Oxford, is theologians are looking for people to talk to who care about the same things. And that the perception, and John Hicks' name comes up several times, you mentioned, is that scholars of religion can fall into the position of saying, well, since we can't know what it is, or we can't know whether one position is better than another, then we can't possibly care about it with the same intensity or passion. Whereas theologians who do care and do believe there's some kind of revelation also can make find a resemblance of what they believe even to people in other traditions who believe very differently. And then finally, just two other points. One would be the difference between confessional and comparative theology, and the difference between comparative philosophy and comparative theology. And I think you're right again that it's useful to make such distinctions and to talk about a confessional theology within a community and then a comparative theology which is not bound in the same ways by the community, and that's a helpful distinction to make. And it's also useful to distinguish the histories of comparative philosophy and comparative theology, and then as you do, to wonder about whether these are merging and whether it's becoming harder to distinguish these categories. But I think it's also useful in both cases to overcome the differences and keep the differences. So with confessional and comparative theology, I would personally, I'd be very uncomfortable if somehow he said, well, certain people at Boston College are the confessional theologians and you're one of the comparative theologians. That wouldn't make sense to me as a way to work. I think sometimes comparative theologians are in fact driven by confessional concerns, and even if they're doing it implicitly and only negatively, confessional theologians have a consciousness of what they're not doing, and that has to be a kind of comparative work they're doing. The only comparative philosophy program I know about is the one at the University of Chicago. Paul Griffiths and his work there, and he's left it for something else now. But it seemed the way they were describing it in the divinity school there was that it was closer to, it was somewhere between the history of religions and comparative theology was comparative philosophy. And so issues like truth or verification could become alive, but that issues of revelation or salvation weren't quite yet on the table, and that may be why Paul moved on from there. And so one could sort these out again, even though they're not actually the same. And then finally, my last comment is, what would be good examples of how these things matter? As many of you know, I mean, a lot of my work always is start with some concrete example and say, or I'm reading a certain Hindu text or going to a certain monastery in Tibet or reading the Quran or whatever. How does this play out, whether a scholar of religion or a theologian or a comparative theologian can understand these things differently or better? Does it make any difference on the ground, or how does it make a difference, or is it just a matter of who you're talking to, whether it makes a difference? So those are somewhat rambling reflections, but they sort of just touch on your points in various ways.
No, I don't think I disagree with anything you've said. I think that's good. Because you could say we belong to different internal Christian traditions.
Yeah.
You could say. I mean, it depends how you split these things up. I mean, people, when I was young, used to say Catholics and Protestants were two different religions. In England, anyway, it's not usual to say that these days. You say it's the same religion.
Yeah.
So there's a certain fluidity about how you count yourself as belonging to something.
Yeah.
And certainly, you will know Julius Lippner in Cambridge, who comes from Goa, and he is married to Hindu, and calls himself a Vedantin Christian. So maybe, you know, someone, Raimondo Panikkar would be another instance of somebody who lived in two traditions and really did live in them, and also got married. I'm not sure about that. But, I mean, he's a Catholic priest.
Well, he didn't want to live
with his. That sort of spoils the story, anyway.
He told me he didn't want to live with his housekeeper, so he really should marry her. I was on email the other day with a recent graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, which is Presbyterian, and he had read my book, The Hindu God, Christian God, and said this would cause great, vast problems from a Presbyterian perspective, and he was trying to explain why at Princeton this approach, which seemed to him so Catholic, wouldn't work. So I think these kind of Christian denominational differences can play out, and then I would think, depending on what kind of Hindu you are, or Buddhist or Muslim, you get similar reactions to what's possible and what's not possible.
Yeah.
Even if we all end up doing similar things, we may have different attitudes toward how to weight them and cautions and so on.
Yeah. But I think we need to remember that one of the problems we have with young 18-year-old students coming to Oxford to read theology as a subject is that their home churches will often tell them not to do it. I mean, so that's a problem we have. And so what effect is this going to have? Well, none, if churches say don't do that. So there are, within religious communities, yeah, there are certainly groups who isn't reflecting at all in this rather necessarily critical at times way.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
I think we can open it. I'm sure there are many thoughts and questions, particularly beginning with what Professor Ward is saying. Peggy?
Can I just touch on three areas which you probably might like to come back to? First of all, despite the breadth of the Greek roots, it is the case that the word like theory can be associated in particular, let's just say, in the UK, with the Christian tradition and historically with what about experimenting as some in the religion I think people have made this question before with other words? People like the word transcendence, or I don't have transcendent theology, or ultimology, or reality. Would that make a point that one is in some sense embarking on something that is slightly different, despite the continuities that you have also been identified as many people there? With what has gone before, which many people, certainly many people in religious studies, really do associate with particular style and tradition. And along with that, which I think Frank touched on, is there a limitation in linking with ideas and doctrines which do seem, despite some examples in Gatan, to be what the main focus is? Because if one is thinking broadly of religious spiritual life, comparative mythology, comparative ethics, comparative law, comparative visual arts, comparative pilgrimage, comparative ritual, is every bit as important as ideas. In fact, the majority of the world's members of religions are probably more involved in some or all of those areas than they are in thinking through in a rigorous philosophical, theological kind of way. The second thing is just the three kinds of phenomenology that you've described, and linking the first, but not the third kind, particularly with Gwen and Smart Story founding the religious studies department. Because although, of course, there's discourse about objectivity, linking with the ethical, of putting aside value judgments, objective and this, as it were, in full-blown Christian perception, I'll try to pull that aside. But he talks constantly about sympathetic imagination of his work. So actually the third sort of phenomenology is very much part of his favourite saying, was never judge a person till you've walked a mile in their moccasins. So, you know, that seems to me to be a false distinction of his work. And then another kind of very broad area, if it's important for us that person engaged in study has the warmth of personal involvement, commitment that these issues really are warmly important to them, then what's the difference between what we think we're doing and what we're just doing?
Okay, can I Ninian Sparks Moccasins first. Yeah, I agree. I mean, in Husserl himself, Husserl clearly has all three in his definition. I mean, he has epoche, setting aside, bracketing truth, questions of truth. Then he has eidetic intuition, which is finding the essence of things. And he also has empathy. My point is really that these things actually don't go well together. And if you're trying to be value-free, you can't have empathy as well.
Well,
not really, because empathy really is, in a sense of Einfühlung, it is the sense of actually feeling the same, having the same feeling, being one in feeling, really. Now, isn't that a problem about...
Well, I would say not, actually, because it's setting aside value judgment at primary, which is all else, and then entering into someone else's world. And by doing that, the person who's talked most about the stages needed, and therefore how one might train a composer. Many And many times, certainly I remember the early days of religious studies in Lancaster, there were beautiful ideals set before people, but then there was always the question, well, how do you actually manage to do this? How do you train in a way that, for instance, contemporary, even not 20 years ago, anthropologists are trained to do this? The oldest anthropologist, it wasn't true in earlier days, but it's certainly is now. And I think the person who's most taken forward to my knowledge, what it might involve to train people, and that's been able to work in the African context, is Jim Cox, who's actually documented how to go about this community to respond to enabling them to do things like this and enter into somebody else's work before you then come back. So it's very much that sort of vision. I don't think people who work that way see it as much as a community.
No, but they should, I think.
Well, the test is whether they're drunk.
Yes.
And
but now I think there is a deep problem about who you can empathise with. All right, you put it, and it's most severe probably. Would you do this sort of empathetic study of the British National Front?
Well, you could see, you could learn to understand why such people hold positions and act as they do. It does not mean that you actually do it. I mean, the anthropologist didn't participate in the population thing, right? You're there when there's a ritual drink. You might come to understand what's going on and why it's done, but the command isn't that you participate in the ritual. There is a boundary there. But that doesn't disenable you from actually understanding why it's going on and being able to describe that clearly.
I don't think that's very clear. I mean, I do think there are big theoretical problems here between. The two extremes would be Alistair McIntyre, who at one time at least held that you can only understand a religion if you're not a member of it. because only then do you really see what's driving it. You're deceived by what your fellows are telling you. And at the other extreme, people, perhaps like Peter Winch, but people who would say, no, you have to actually know what it's like to be a member of the National Front. Well, my feelings about that is that I don't want to know what it's like to be a member of the British National Front. It's the last thing I want to know. It might be corrupting to find out what it was like. So I'd have problems about that. The sort of thing I was suggesting, empathy in the sense of have a, like, my analogy was with appreciation of music. That really, if you're doing music, part of that, you wouldn't do it unless you wanted to appreciate the beauty of it. And my suggestion was, well, in religion, perhaps it's something I want to appreciate the beauty of it. But if there's no beauty there, like in the National Front, there isn't.
But is there a problem? I mean, clearly the National Front, what is ruled out anyway as a true religion?
Well, I don't know. They send me religious literature all the time.
Well,
I don't know why. I've been offended.
I mean, I would want possibly suggest another approach. Maybe an alternative, but there was a when I was in India, we had an interesting period when there were Catholic nuns and Protestant nuns in charge of an ashram where Buddhists and Hindus stayed and would join in the worship. And the comment made by one of the priests there was that it would seem that the more the closer we get to the centre, the premise was that there is a centre beyond the diversity, the closer we get to each other. And so in a sense, the depth of inquiry into the ritual and the prayer and the meditation actually proved to be an aid for understanding one another.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's.
I think that's. I still find that different from what first sense phenomenologists would do. That is, I find it different from just trying to describe the phenomena.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, you think it is?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Perhaps you don't think I should put Linear Smart into that box, but there is such a box. Anyway.
Yes, can you discuss how the different sorts of description, thick description, different sorts of description?
Yeah, would you like to elaborate on that, please?
Yes, there are descriptions which are much richer in terms of that stuff, and there are descriptions which are less factual and move across the surface. But
right.
Before description.
Yeah.
There is a qualitative difference there, and I would call it more knowledge, and there's that qualitative
I only want to empathise with what seems good to you. I'm putting the stress on the word empathy, which is the word Husserl uses, for example. And
as opposed to sympathy.
As opposed to sympathy, yes. But even sympathy, I wouldn't want to sympathise with the National Front. I mean, and Aztecs, I wouldn't want to sympathise with them either. They're safely dead, I think, so it's all right. But you know, people going for child sacrifice and stuff like that, I don't want to sympathise with that. And this is Alistair McIntyre's point. If to understand that sort of thing, you have to feel revulsion at it.
That seems to me to cut off a very enormous part of what, in not just in historical humanist terms, but contemporary terms, about full humanity, which in Christian theology takes on board this thing as well as being human. Isn't that important? That, and do we really think we've got no line on that?
Oh, I'm capable of it, yes.
Part of that.
I don't even sympathise with it.
But isn't there a parallel with the word, I mean, obviously philosophy, at least traditionally implies a love of wisdom, the very word philosophy. And it seems to me that if you are using the word religion, there must be an implication of it's the opposite of negligence, isn't it? Negligens, relegens. There's a sense in which it is to do with care. And if the group that you're talking about call themselves religious and they're tearing people apart, I think they're actually denying the very nature of the word. People can say I'm religious and be killing people, but actually, that's actually a nonsense.
I mean, in that case, I would say the sort of understanding I would want is more like a sociologist's explanation. How on earth could people get themselves into a state where they're doing this sort of thing? But it's not the sense of saying, I would really like to experience what it's like to be in this situation. And those are different sorts of understanding, aren't they, really?
Let me bring in your other two questions and then try to give a chance for other people to jump in, because they're all interesting. On that one, just practically on the empathy issue, I find it very useful for myself is to, you know, in picking it, when I take up an issue for consideration or a topic, one of the things you do have to calculate is how much you can empathize. And I don't think there's going to be a single standard. You either do or don't, but to what degree? And I know reading, you know, my dissertation was on Hindu ritual text, and I wasn't performing the rituals. But when I worked on South Indian devotional literature, I was going to the temples. And now I'm reading a tantric text, and I'm probably not going to perform tantric rituals. So, I mean, there are different things, even within the boundaries of what's more or less positive about how far you go. And I think the big thing is to calculate for yourself, given who I am, what kind of empathy do I have. But just to add in the other two, and then try to get other voices in, I keep the word theology as opposed to transcendentology or rheology, because it's very important for me to talk to people who call themselves theologians. And I know lots of theologians who say, well, if you're doing realology, we're doing theology, so I'll never have to read anything you write. and luckily, we'll go to different conferences from now on. So in part for me, it's a strategic thing about keeping claim on the word theology when talking to Christian theologians. Now, a friend of mine in Boston, John McCransky, who's a Tibetan Buddhist scholar, he just co-edited a volume recently called Buddhist Theology. And they go through all the apologies at the beginning about how Buddhists don't believe in God and so on, but say, of the terms they knew were available for thinking about being a Buddhist in North America, and kind of constructing Buddhist identity in the North American context, they thought theology was a term that worked better than other terms that they could think of trying to capture a conversation. the issue of doctrines and other kinds of things, I think that's 100% true, that a lot of people live their lives in pilgrimage and prayers and images and symbols and so on, and any kind of theology, just Christian theology, that would reduce to doctrinal study would be very impoverished. And we can do comparative work. I think some people can focus on doctrines, but there has to be this much broader thing. And then finally, on the what's the difference between comparative theology and dialogue?
Is that true? Really, just now, as you talked about the necessity
of I mean, personally, I would see it. I mean, I think of theology, and therefore comparative theology, as kind of professional disciplines, and that one trains for them, one goes to university, one gets degrees, and so on. And that they're whatever, you know, whatever you do when you go to a university and get a PhD or something, you're. It's not that you're cut off from the rest of the human race, but that you're professionalized, or in a way. And I think while dialogue can happen on all kinds of levels, all kinds of interactions that don't require advanced disciplinary reflection, there's a way in which the comparativist is dealing with a certain level of technicality or a certain level of self-consciousness about the problems of methodology and so on that may not be operative in all kinds of dialogue. But other people want to jump in, either with this particular point of conversation, Peggy's questions, or just other things from what Keith was saying earlier.
Add something, going back to what you said earlier, Dr. Ward, you talked about how different local churches will have some difficulty with sending their young people to study theology here, which I can sympathize with on a certain level, in that, I mean, if some Protestant church, then some Protestant church probably won't want their favorite son to come study Aquinas or something, you know, perverting from the true way. But on another level, comparative theology could be something which might be very threatening, because it might suggest that the goal of studying other traditions is to reduce the confusion in a particular tradition. And so these particular churches might risk obliteration in that, that the end goal is that there will be none of them, but there will be some sort of unity among lots of different traditions, and in that they would fear losing their own identity and whatever valuable that they have. And I'm wondering how you would address that on two levels. First, theoretically, is this a problem theoretically? I mean, how to retain the distinctiveness of a particular tradition while studying many? And is there a point to retaining distinctiveness, or is it a disadvantage that there are many distinctive traditions, or is that an advantage? And that whole list of questions. And then secondly, practically, how to communicate to an individual body that in fact comparative theology has something positive to offer them, and that they won't lose everything if they support it. Yeah, because if this is going to go forward, which I hope it does, it will need the support of people. And so that's something to do.
Yeah. Well, that's a start for that, perhaps the second one first. I think it is a worry that a lot of people have. I think it's a real worry. And I think some of my own colleagues probably have it. And if you enter into any sort of discussion which does involve extending the boundaries beyond which you've lived until then, you may indeed change your views. I mean, it is something that may happen. You can't preclude that. But I think... So that's what I meant in my very last sentence by saying it could be seen as dangerous. I mean, yes, for certain people it would. You probably have to, I mean, that is dangerous for some views, just as theology itself is dangerous for some views. If you're never going to compare Luke with John, and that might be a dangerous thing to do with, in some way. But the positive virtue of it, I think you could... Well, let's take it from a specific point of view, from a Christian point of view, because you've been to a specific Christian church. And I think the what a place I would locate it as, it's a Christian obligation to love everyone. I mean, your neighbour being everyone. And you can't love without understanding. It's impossible to love somebody if you don't understand something about them. And so it's it becomes an obligation of love to understand the different things that people think. I think as you, well, it's my experience anyway, as you study different religious traditions, you find that the differences are as important as the similarities. I mean, there are lots of differences, obviously. So you're not in danger of obliterating differences and making one new religion. Or if you did, you'd just have one new religion. You'd have another difference to talk about. So you're not, I think in practice, there's no danger of obliterating differences. See, and John Hagen, who I've mentioned, is a very good case of this, because you might think he obliterates differences. This is a wide perception of John Hagen, though it's actually quite incorrect, because he's precisely wanted to say, because we don't know the real in itself, there are and should be lots of differences. So he's not somebody who's saying they're all actually the same. He's somebody who's saying they're all actually quite different, though there is something unknowable to which they point. So I think anybody who does comparative theology will be bound to say there are differences, and there will always be differences. It's not a subject which is trying, which has any interest really in trying to make everything the same. But I think that would be one response. I don't know what you'd say.
I would just add to it, I think it's not a question should we think comparatively or not, but are we going to do it well or not? And I think even communities that are very kind of deliberately kind of self-consciously think of themselves as not what everybody else is doing and not wanting to get involved in all that stuff and so on are doing comparisons all the time, and often ill-informed comparisons about, you know, we don't want to be like the liberals, or we don't want to be like the pagans, or we don't want to be like the academicians. They might as well know what they're talking about since they're doing it. And now they may not like to hear that either, but I think they are comparativists, so they might as well be good ones. Was there a first question?
There was. I too cannot bring it to
well, it was just theoretically how to deal with the distinctiveness of traditions. I think you addressed that.